Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room is Jim Oines speaking about Sanctuary for Central Americans, a personal story. So let's listen to Jim.
Have you had any involvement with sanctuary work or Central America or anything like that? But she was just telling. Maybe you can tell this group a little bit about
them. Well, I was interested in hearing what this gentleman had to say because several years ago there was a Salvadoran refugee that was given sanctuary at St. Luke's Presbyterian Church in Minnetonka, where my daughter belongs. And they heard about him from someplace in Chicago, so a couple members of the church went to Chicago to bring him back to their church. And they had a bed there and they brought food for him, and my daughter became very well acquainted with them and sort of took him on and is part of their family. So he's been part of my family ever since. Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter, everything, he's part of the family. And he was telling about how he managed to escape. He evidently was vocal about opposing the government or the powers that be.
The Salvadoran government.
Yeah. And he was coming home from work one day and he saw a government officer's car in front of his home. He lived with his parents there. And he knew that they were after him, and if they got him, he would be shot. So he just took off and ran off and finally got his way to the American embassy, and they got him passage to the United States. And from there, there was something that sheltered him. he was really...
I don't think he went to the American embassy.
Oh, he didn't. He didn't. Okay.
He wouldn't have done that because he'd be dead if he would.
Okay. Well, he somehow got some help to get out of there and get to the United States. But you said too that the INS.
I know his story a little bit. I don't think he went to the American embassy at all. But you're right. He did come to the U.S. And I'll maybe talk a little bit about how most.
Yeah.
Folks.
Well, you know him as well.
I know. I've met him. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm Martha Olson, and from Port Orchard, Washington, and I have had no involvement. I just was interested in coming.
Yeah. I'm Donald Walker. I guess reading Solzhenitsyn and Bonhoeffer and their times in prison interests me in this kind of people.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, and where are you from?
Iowa.
Are you retired?
Well, retired but working part-time. Visitation desk.
Where are you from?
Gowrie.
I'm from Strawberry Point. You look familiar.
Oh, we served at Aurora.
Oh, did you?
About 30 years.
Oh, well, I wasn't there then.
Okay.
And I'm Dale Whitman. My wife and I have been on mission trips in Mexico a couple times, taking youth on building mission trips at an orphanage there, and once built a dormitory for a sanctuary. Folks who weren't aware of it. Spent some time in El Salvador and Nicaragua as well.
Where are you from?
Well, most recently from Strawberry Point, Iowa.
Oh.
Originally from California.
You're from about the San Francisco, Oakland area? I found it in talking about these things that the best way to start is to do a little bit like, I think probably the reason we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the first part of the New Testament is they're told like stories. And I found that a story can tell tell information a little better than any other monk, that there's really no other way. So I, what I'd like to do is just sort of tell you my story, and when I tell you my story, I think what I'll be doing is telling you the story of a lot of other people too, because it's a similar story that happened to a lot of other people that were sort of in our situation. And so I served a two-point parish in South Dakota for 3 years, and then, but before that I had gone to Latin America three times before that, and one of them was a long bicycle trip that I took with three friends, that we went from Detroit, Michigan to La Paz, Bolivia. And so as when I went on that trip, a couple things happened that affected what was going to happen later. One was that I learned Spanish, and the second one was that I went through El Salvador and Guatemala and some of these other countries. And we actually went from Mexico all the way to Bolivia, so all the countries in between, and got to know them. And then after I served 3 years at this two-point parish in South Dakota, I kind of felt like it was a good experience, but I felt like there were lots of people that could be a pastor in that place. But knowing Spanish and things, I felt like I was needed somewhere else, you know. So then I got a call to this church in Phoenix, and it was a church that was in the center of the city, Alzona Lutheran Church, and it was a church, you know, that was losing members because it was all Germans and Norwegians and Swedes that had come from the Midwest and moved to Phoenix. And now it was the middle of Phoenix, and mostly was Hispanic people living around the church, and the middle class white people had moved out to the suburbs, you know. And so this church needed to make a transition to somehow minister in that community. And so I wasn't there very long, and this is just a small part of the story, but just to kind of illustrate how some of the things that happened, this man came into the church, and this was, I think, in late 1980. I moved there in 79. And he says, and we were speaking Spanish, and he says, I don't have any place to live. I don't know where to go. I don't have any food, And I said, we talked a little bit, and I said, what part of Mexico are you from, And he says, oh, I'm not from Mexico. I'm from El Salvador. And then he says, I said, I've been to El Salvador, and what, whereabouts? And he said, Santa Ana. And Santa Ana is a city that's right on the Pan-American Highway, and we had gone through there on our bicycles, and I could see the city in my mind, I've been there. And I think that helped me sort of relate to him, and been to El Salvador. And on our trip, I think I was pretty naive about what was going on in Latin America during that time, but I learned a lot there, and then I learned a lot since then. And
what year again was the bicycle trip?
We started out in 74 and got to Bolivia in 75. Yeah. It took almost a year. And then I went back and finished my last year of seminary, and then I served those 3 years in South Dakota, and then I went to Phoenix. So I'm always an advocate for young people doing some kind of international experience when they're young, because that just completely changed my world, to see how other cultures work, to see how much poverty there is in other parts of the world, I think of my life as being pre-bike trip and post-bike trip, this man, I searched around to try to figure out a way for him to get food and to get something to eat and things like that, then I also got connected with a family of, come on, sit right up here with us. Come on up here.
Like this cushion.
Okay. this family came, and this was a family from El Salvador, and they were very involved with trying to help other refugees from El Salvador, and they were really overwhelmed because they were from El Salvador themselves and did not have any connections in the United States. And so they started asking me, you know, to help and work with them. And so I did, and started to realize that, and I get phone calls, you know, any time of the day or night from this family, or, and after a while after I got to know other Salvadorans, I'd start getting phone calls from other people, you know, so-and-so just got arrested by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. That's, and I'll abbreviate that INS. And you know, the Internal Revenue Service is IRS, and INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service. And so I would go down and I would visit these, sometimes the refugees, and we would try to get, and many of them, this refugee family explained to me a lot, and I already knew by this time what our, a little bit about what our government was doing in El Salvador, and that it wasn't really safe for people to go back. And that it was like the man you were talking about, many of these people had run a great danger of being killed. I'll just give you an example. There was one man who had been working for it was a cooperative of people that were publishing an alternative newspaper. And one day, his secretary came and knocked on his office door and said, there's the police are here, the Hacienda police, that's called the Treasury police, are here, and they want to talk to you. Well, he was fortunate that he had another way out of his back door. And because the Hacienda police at that time were notorious for being the ones that ran the death squads. And so he went out the back office door, went to his home, got his wife, and they didn't have any children yet, he's quite young, and left within an hour and a half of their, and never to ever return again. That's something you might think about if you ever had to do that. Would you be able to just leave everything you have, not be able to say goodbye to anybody, and just leave? That's something that I do admire about so many of these folks, is the reason they're alive is for some reason they were not attached too much to material things or anything else, and they were able to just do like the Jews did in Egypt, just leave. One night's warning and leave, you know. But anyway, they came up. This is one man and his wife who came to the United States. But anyway, what happened, I started then talking in Phoenix to other pastors, and especially the pastors in the center of the city where a lot of the refugees came, told me about similar experiences. And they told me about hearing from similar people, that their people were coming to them wondering what to do. Now, the issue was, is, and you might say, well, why didn't you just go to the INS and talk to them? Well, we did. We went to the Immigration and Naturalization Service and said, you know, these people are refugees. They need to be protected. And they said, no, they aren't. They're not refugees. They're economic refugees, they said. They said, there really isn't any danger for them there. It's just that the country's a poor country, and that that if they go back, they'll be hungry. They had a well-rehearsed line, which was everyone wants to come to the United States because we're a wealthy country, and they're just coming here because, and I had INS agents tell me, because they want a TV and a car. That's why they've come. And throughout the bureaucracy in the INS, that was pretty much the same line. they would quote it, these are economic refugees. Now you have to also remember that in 1980, Ronald Reagan became president. And if you remember, I think all of you would remember that campaign and what it was about. A lot of what the campaign in 1980 was about was to stop communism. Reagan, you know, really played on this idea that if we don't stop communism, they're going to overwhelm us. And he even talked about the communists from Nicaragua, which is a country of 3.2 million people, a poverty-stricken country. He even talked in one of his speeches that they were going to come up through El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico and attack the United States, and that this was going to destroy our country, this communism. And people voted for Reagan because of things like that. And so after he was in office then, he really also had to do something that really showed that he was going to stop communism. And I like to say that he sort of closed his eyes and pointed to the map, and his finger fell on El Salvador. And because at the time in El Salvador, there had been organized for years in a popular movement that included almost every sector of El Salvador. And you need to know a little bit of the history of El Salvador to understand this, and I'll speak later a little bit about Guatemala, is that for years El Salvador has been ruled by a kind of an elite group of families that were called for years the 14 families. There were 14 families who really owned all the land and the rest of the... And El Salvador is one of the most populated countries in the Western Hemisphere, second only to Haiti. And there are 5.2 million people in El Salvador. So it's just this very small piece of land. And it's probably about the size of Chelan County. I don't know. It's not very big. So there were always social movements to try to change the situation because these 14 families ran the army and the military and ran the economic system and everything in the country. In the 1940s, a man by the name of Farabundo Martí was one of the leaders of a movement to change the society. And at that time, there were still a lot of Indian-speaking people. People spoke their Indian dialect or Indian language. And they got pretty well organized and became a pretty strong threat to the government. Well, there was a president at the time by the name of Romero, who had no relation to Oscar Romero, who was assassinated later, the bishop, who at that time felt pretty threatened, and he then organized the army, and in within about 2 months' time, about 40,000 peasants were killed in El Salvador. And since that day, Salvadorans, even if their heritage is Indian, do not speak their Indian languages, because they went around and would kill anyone who spoke an Indian language. And the signal was, the Indians are organizing against us, so anyone that's an Indian needs to be killed. And the message was, and since then, many of these countries have developed a more refined art, even of this kind of control by terror, and it's by state terrorism. And this has gone on for years. It goes on, especially in Guatemala and El Salvador, and it continues. And the United States has continued to support and give money and military training to these countries as well. During this whole period of time, we have always been aligned with those governments. So what we faced with as refugees came was a dual problem. One was that our government was saying that there is no problem in El Salvador. By now, again, the movement that started in the 40s had regrouped again, and there were strong labor unions in El Salvador, strong church groups, strong student movements, and by now, after what was called a golpe de Estado in 1980, where there were four men, two of the military officers, who even two of these military officers were disgusted with the government and wanted a more democratic form of government, and two civilians joined together and they formed what they call a government junta, which was a sort of an agreement between the military and these two civilians that they would try to run the government until there could be a new kind of election. Well, before there was an election, two of these people were assassinated by the military, and the other two had to leave the country then. And then after that, the popular organizations organized into four different guerrilla army groups. That doesn't mean that all the people joined in the military or guerrilla movement. That meant that a lot of people then began to take up arms. And so from 1979 on all the way till 1989, there was a combination of an armed guerrilla movement and mass organizing in the Salvadoran society to try to change the Salvadoran government. And so that meant then, of course, that the Salvadoran government then armed even more. And the people that they appealed to first in 1979 was Jimmy Carter. And they asked, the Salvadoran government asked Jimmy Carter for money to beef up their army, and he gave it to them. And he gave them some money, and then when Reagan was elected, he about tripled it, and then from then on, up until the time, throughout most of the 80s, we were sending about $1 million a day to El Salvador, the United States government, sending it directly to their government. And most of that money was used for the military to buy guns, to buy bombers, to buy bombs, landmines, to train the military. We brought many people up to what's called the School of the Americas, which is in Fort Benning, Georgia, which many people have said actually, at one period in its time, actually taught people to torture, how to torture. And that has been eliminated. We know that the torture school is done, but we still train people who do go down to torture because they know how to torture people. And so at that time, the government used other methods. They used the death squad method, which was mostly to go out and in a village that they felt was strongly aligned with the guerrillas, or had it, in many cases there didn't need to be any armed guerrillas in the village at all, only if they were involved with the popular movements like the labor unions, or if they had strong church groups like base community groups, which are groups that would get together and look at the Bible, and they would ask questions. They would let the Bible ask them questions about why are we poor? Why are we so poor that if a child is born and they have diarrhea and we don't even have enough money to buy two tablets of diarrhea medicine that would save the child's life? They would ask questions, what does the Bible say about that? Why? You know? And so they would become very politically aware. And so those villages as well were targeted by the government. That had strong church-based community movements. And so what we began to see in the early 80s then, when the government reacted to the organizing of the society, is that thousands of refugees came to the United States. And then, of course, since the United States was involved in the repression of the movement for change, and we were saying that this is purely communist, that this is some, and therefore it's all purely evil. There were people in all across the spectrum in the movement for change. There were thorough-going Marxists, all the way over to people who were very, like European social democrats, to people who even Christian democrats. Napoleon Duarte for a while was even a part of the movement, and he eventually became part of the government, but even the Christian Democrats were part of the movement for change. And they're usually considered quite conservative. But what happened then through this repression is people came to the United States, but our government was saying that this is all economic, and that these people are not really refugees. And the government was saying that for two reasons. One was that they probably didn't want any more refugees in the United States. It was the Reagan administration, and the Reagan also was anti-immigration, anti-immigrant. But secondly, mainly because they didn't want people telling their real story. The story like Rene Hurtado, that the police came. They wanted people to think that it was the guerrillas that was killing everybody. And the guerrillas did kill some people, but by far now, after the investigations and that we knew all through this time, and we tried to tell the press and people, was that about 90% of the people killed during the war in El Salvador were killed by the government, mostly by the death squads. So the other ones that were killed were killed by the guerrillas in armed conflict with the government. And sometimes there were small groups of guerrillas that would go into villages and assassinate people who were involved with the government. But that was very seldom, and it was usually the government that used the death squad tactic. Most of the research has been done by now that the mass executions, the killings of almost whole villages, you've heard of Mosote maybe, where an entire village was destroyed by the government. The Sempul River was a place where refugees were fleeing the government, and they were trying to swim across the river to Honduras to get free, Salvadoran government killed about 400 people in the river, in the Sempul River, as they were trying to get across, unarmed people. The government constantly was bombing villages that were unarmed because they had this theory. They said, in order to kill the fish, drain the swamp. And the idea was that the guerrillas, and it was true, the guerrillas, they said, swim among the population. And it's true, because most of the guerrillas had a mother, brothers, sisters that they would go back to for food, that they would go back to for rest, that they would go back to for spiritual sustenance. And because the guerrillas were from all the people, they were from everywhere. And it's true that what they did, and so the theory the government said was, in order to get that one fish, kill the whole, or drain the swamp, was the idea. In other words, kill all the whole population so that you get that one gorilla. And those theories, you know, when we theorize about people, human life, and we abstractively hurt a lot of people. So as these people came, people all across the board in the United States were having experiences like I had. People would come to their churches. People would even knock on their doors across the border. There were people in remote places, wonderful people that I met, who people, when they crossed the border, like on little ranches, they were usually people of Hispanic heritage, Mexican people who had little ranchitos, they call them, on the border. People would knock on the door and say, I'm starving. And they would take them in, and then they would call the churches that they knew were involved in this and send them to the churches. And so people all across the border were having these experiences. And I remember one young man who came to Phoenix. His name was Carlos, who had been involved in a labor union. And he got picked up by the death squads. And the death squads wanted to know from him who the other people that were the leaders were. So they took him in to a room and they put a bag, they call it a capucha, a bag, a capucha. They put lime in it and they put the bag over his head and they tied it and then they hit him with a baseball bat. And way of torture, and then they would ask him, and they didn't kill him. Sometimes they didn't kill people. We think that some of the reason that they didn't kill people sometimes was that they wanted people out there saying, I was tortured by the government. And the signal is then, if you do what I did, you'll get tortured too. If you join the labor union, you'll get tortured like I was tortured. And so the government wants some people to live and be out there and telling people what the government's willing to do to stop the movement. And he came to the United States, and he told the judge this whole story, and the judge didn't believe it, and the judge deported him back to El Salvador. He went back to his village and. Because he didn't have any place else to go. He needed the support of his family. And when he got back there, some of the same officers were there. And they arrested him again, but this time he escaped. But as he was escaping, they shot him in the leg, but he was able to get away. He's an amazing story because he's the person that survived twice, and which is almost, you can hardly ever hear that. He got back to the United States, and the judge deported him. And the judge said, how do I know? And he showed the judge the bullet wounds. And the judge said, how do I know you didn't get those wounds in a fight in a bar?
Yeah.
And so this time he just came back and went to Mexico. He didn't try to go to the United States again until later. Then he was able to come and he waited a while before he came to the U.S. And from then on, things had changed. By the time he got back again, the whole scene had changed, which I'll try to tell you about a little bit. So anyway, we were wrestling with a couple questions. Now, pretty soon we realized that early on in the game, we realized we felt it would be immoral to turn anyone into the United States government. Even though the law says that if you know about somebody that's undocumented, you're supposed to tell them who they are. But then we started looking into some laws, like international law. And one of the things that we found was that there's a law which is called the law of non-refoulement, which is a French word, but that you do not refoul a person. In other words, that a person shall not be sent back to a country of danger. And it says that, and then it was written up in the 1967 protocols, UN protocol, which says that anyone who flees or fears persecution for reasons of race, religion, political opinion, membership in a particular social group shall not be deported back to that place. And that's an international law. And our government signed that law, and it was ratified by Congress in the very year, 1980, and it was called the 1980 Refugee Act. And that was signed by Congress right before all the publicity, about a year before, because there didn't come much publicity until about, it didn't really even get started until about 1981. And But our officials kept saying, well, these people cross the border without papers. Well, if anyone tried to go across the border, of course our government would say, no, we won't let you in. And we usually would then capture them, take them to a deportation station. In our area, they would then take them to Los Angeles, put them on airplanes, and fly them back to El Salvador. And so we began to realize that we felt just that it would be immoral to turn anyone over to the U.S. government. For a while, we started talking about this, then we said, well, okay, we'll try to protect these refugees. But then we began to realize, too, that if we did this only quietly, that a couple things still would go on. Is that we could only protect a few, which were the people that we knew about and who would come to us. And secondly, at the same time then, the government at one time was deporting about 400 Salvadorans a month, sending back. Can you imagine? Add that up in airline tickets. About 400 people a month deported back to El Salvador. So we began to realize that if we only did it quietly, the government was still going to be able to do what it was doing. It's just a cap, because they have this force of people along the border. It was going to be capturing lots and lots of people, deporting lots of people, and the policy was not going to change. And so people were really wrestling with what to do. And we started talking about in Phoenix about this idea of sanctuary city. And we actually approached the INS and said, if you turn the refugees over to us, we will find places for them to stay. So we did that for a while. But then we realized that they were only turning over to us the refugees we knew about. We realized that if we knew about somebody and we called them and we said, okay, so-and-so, you have so-and-so, that they would turn them over to us. But they were probably deporting 200, 300 people every time they told us about one. And so we realized that they had really deceived us. And then this little church in Tucson, a Presbyterian church, in discussion with a Quaker house, came up with an idea. They said, and they did this through biblical study of sanctuary in the Bible. They studied passages like Leviticus, if a sojourner sojourns in your land, do them no harm, for you were once strangers in the land of Egypt. And that whole ethic, in Hebrews, for example, where it says that be kind to strangers and be hospitable to them, because by doing that, some people have entertained angels. And so they studied about what is sanctuary. There were sanctuary cities in the Old Testament. You've probably heard about them, where people who were fleeing for various reasons were to be protected. The whole idea then, we began to realize that this whole idea of sanctuary is a big idea. It's really got lots of ramifications. And what they did then is they came up with what I think is one of the most brilliant modern ramifications of what I would call nonviolent direct action that has been come up with probably since Martin Luther King Jr., is that the idea was for a refugee who wanted to do this, and this refugee wanted to do it, the refugee put a blindfold on, and he sat in front of a television camera, and then the people from the church, the pastor, a few other people there, were there, and they announced publicly that this person didn't have their papers to be in the United States. They were undocumented, or the government liked to say that they were illegal. And, or, but they were undocumented, but that this church was going to protect them. And fully knowing the pastor and the other people that they could be indicted and probably convicted for a felony of smuggling illegal aliens. And they did it publicly. And the model for that were some of the things that Gandhi developed in India when he would publicly break a British law and do it with the press there. Have you ever seen the movie Gandhi? And do you remember in the early time when he burned a document that said that Indian people could only live in certain places or could do only certain jobs? And he organized a group of people. And of course, it was against the law to burn this document. And he said, I know it's against the law to burn this document, and I'm going to burn this document in front of the world. I'm not going to go in my room and hide and do it. I'm going to do it publicly. And this is what these folks did. And then as soon as they did that, churches all over the country declared sanctuary and did the same thing. Because people were searching for a way to do this, and this little church came up with this idea. And it was one of those, I don't know if any of you have ever experienced in your lives, Kairos times, when things were right so that other people could see the truth, and then it formed. So then what happened was, this little church in Tucson, and we had been doing a lot of discussing with them about what do we do in our church. And by this time, we had organized an ecumenical task force, and the same thing had happened in Tucson. And we were in Phoenix, and they're about 90 miles apart, and Tucson's about 100 miles from the border. And so what we agreed to do was, in arrangements with a group from Chicago called the Chicago Religious Task Force, in our group called the Valley Religious Task Force on Central America, and a group in Tucson called the Tucson Ecumenical Council, is that we would do three different parts of sanctuary, and some of us would do all of it, is that the people from Tucson would bring the people across the border to Tucson, and they would bring them up to Phoenix. And then we had, in our church, we had a Catholic sister. The first one was named Darlene Nagorski. And then we had a series of, after she left, some others, who would interview the refugees. And then she was in communication, and we had a committee, which I was part of. We had what we called a sanctuary committee that we developed, and she was the staff person. And we would all talk to this person, and this person would also kind of learn then to talk to North Americans and explain their story clearly to people. And then the Chicago Religious Task Force then would place people in churches around the country. And that's where Renee went, how he went to the church that you were involved in. Yeah. And so we had this going for a while. And we would every once in a while, I remember there were a number of, one of the very first things that came out on TV was a group came down from National Public Television, or what's it called, PBS, PBS. Getting the radio and the TV mixed up, PBS, there's this show, I don't know if it's still on, it's called Frontline.
Oh, yeah.
And we went out to, there are some groves, and this helps you learn some more about this, outside of Phoenix where many Guatemalan refugees go. Because there were some similar things happening in Guatemala, although somewhat different. If we have time, we'll talk about that. And there were many Guatemalan refugees living in the groves, and there was, some of them wanted to get out of that situation, and some of them were really afraid that they were going to get deported. So this one family we helped, and we helped many others, but I'm just talking about this one, because this family then, this public broadcasting crew of two, a man and a woman, followed this family all the way up to the church where they went. And so there was this whole story in Frontline about Sanctuary. And so by that, then some media started to pay attention to the reality. This is already now a year and a half or 2 years after the real violence has begun in El Salvador. It began in late 1979. And it was going on all through the 80s, but it was a year and a half or two until any of the media really even said anything about the fact that these people might be really refugees. And I remember calling newspapers in Phoenix and telling them about this story. And I remember clearly one reporter saying to me, "But I haven't seen anything like this on the AP wire. So how can this be true? It's not on the AP wire." I mean, for one thing, I think of this benighted person who has probably an opportunity to get a Pulitzer Prize and is wondering what the AP wire is saying. But the other thing is, because I had similar experiences, is beginning to realize that the media in this country is very well controlled by people who really want U.S. government policy to go well, even if it might not be right. And so, especially in Phoenix, where both newspapers are owned by the same company, which is run by the Republican Party. So we had a lot of difficulty with that because, of course, Reagan being a Republican and all that. So during this time, then also something was happening while we were working on the Sanctuary movement to get people. We also noticed that those refugees that stayed in Phoenix really had very few ways to really get together and talk to each other safely for a couple reasons. They were afraid of the INS, the Immigration Service. Secondly, they were afraid of each other because some of the refugees might have been involved in the army. Some of them would have been involved in popular movements. They're afraid to talk to each other. And so Darlene, the sister, Catholic sister we were working with, a man named Mano Barreno, who had studied for the priesthood in Rome, but then he got married, so he couldn't do that. But he was teaching at a school in Phoenix, it was a Presbyterian school for Indian people, a lay training center called Cook School. And so we said, let's do a Bible study. So we did a Bible study on a base community model. We did this, but Randy's going to tell you. We did this Bible study. We started, and it was going along pretty well. And of course, we always had to go get the refugees in their homes because most of them didn't have cars, and Phoenix isn't that much for public transportation. And they would have to come, and we would, and we'd do that. And about 6 months after we started the Bible study, these two men came into it, and one of them said, "I'm a volunteer for the Sanctuary movement." And that was kind of strange to us because we didn't know him. Nobody used that language, volunteer. Everybody pretty well felt like that they had been kind of pulled into it because of just the need, But anyway, they came to the Bible study for a while. And then one morning I got a phone call. And it was from a friend who was working in sanctuary, and she said that 18 people had been indicted for their work with Central American refugees for working in the sanctuary movement. And also then, a light bulb went on for me, and they said, and Jesus Cruz, who was the man that had come into our Bible study group saying he was a volunteer, and Solomon Graham were the ones that were going to be the witnesses against the sanctuary movement. They had been going into churches, including our Bible study group, with hidden microphones and tape recorders hidden in their clothing. And they were recording our Bible study group, they were recording church services, they were recording planning meetings. And so then that, I realized, and I went around to where many of the refugees lived, and about half of them had been picked up at early morning raids on their homes by the INS. And one woman who had just had a baby was taken with her baby, who was only about 5 days old, in her nightgown down to the INS station. Just other horrible stories about just the way that people are treated as non-humans, you know, by the immigration service. I could go on for days about the stories of families being separated. So then we had this long trial of the sanctuary workers, and eventually about nine of them were convicted of harboring and smuggling the illegal aliens. Should tell you a little bit about what our position was in regarding the law. Our position, for a while we were saying that we're going to protect these people, and what we'll be doing will be called civil disobedience. And you've maybe heard of that. It's Henry David Thoreau talked a lot about it. Martin Luther King Jr. used civil disobedience. Gandhi used civil disobedience. But we had a little bit of a conundrum, because civil disobedience means that usually it has come to mean that there's a law, a bad law, that you break in order to call attention to that law in hopes that that law will be changed. And you break that law very deliberately and openly and publicly so that you call people to the attention of how immoral the law is. But the situation was that we had, our main law was a good law, which was that if someone is, we had signed the law, which says that if someone's a refugee, you shall not deport them. And our Congress and our President had signed it. And what was happening was that we had an agency in the government, we felt, that was breaking the law. And that they were the ones that were doing illegal acts. But what happened in the trial was that we drew a judge who would not allow us to even speak about the 1980 Refugee Act. We could not even bring it up in court.
He
said it was irrelevant. Of course, the most relevant law that there was, he says, was irrelevant, which meant that he already knew how he wanted the trial to come out. Which, of course, I shed a lot of naivete during these last years. So what happened with that was that almost everything that was relevant from the defense side of the story, the judge threw out of court. He let very few people testify who could speak relevant things about the situation. He would not allow people to testify about the situation in El Salvador. He said that the law was whether these people crossed the border without papers or not. He said that's the only thing that applies. And so what ended up happening is 9 people got convicted. But to show you how absurd it was, is one of the people who organized this first press conference at Southside Presbyterian Church, Jim Corbett, who was involved almost from the very beginning with defending refugees, was not convicted. And other people who were involved for maybe only a month, some people like myself who were involved for a long, long time, weren't even indicted. Other people who were barely involved were indicted and convicted. And so that shows you a little bit too that when a government agency goes wild and really wants to go after a group, how just myopic they can become, how irrational and how disorganized they can be. So anyway, during this time also different groups, and our church was involved in our Valley Religious Task Force, we're working on another side of the story, which was we were bringing our own lawsuits against the government. And probably the best organized one was called America Baptist Churches versus Ed Meese. Ed Meese was the attorney general at that time. And American Baptist Churches was the title of the lawsuit only because they were the first church, and it starts with A, America. But there were many other churches that were involved. And brought this lawsuit saying that the United States government is violating the law by deporting people back to El Salvador. Well, the advantage that the government had in this whole thing was the advantage of gigantic bureaucracy. One was that while we were helping 3 or 4 people to protect them, was the INS could be picking up 100 people and arresting and deporting 100 people. Another big advantage was is the U.S. government gets sued every day of the week, and they know how to slow down a lawsuit long enough so that it will be irrelevant by the time it's settled. And so that's what they did with this lawsuit. But one of the things they did not figure on is that the war in El Salvador would go on for 10 years. And so it's been about 5 years ago now where finally the government settled on this lawsuit. And finally Congress passed a law that gave temporary extended protection to Salvadoran refugees. And so they were able to stay in the country without being deported. And Guatemalans, through this American Baptist Churches, were also allowed to stay. The ones that had gotten here before a certain date only, though. And that was because of the negotiating that went on in court. So I guess what I've learned from this is that when you're involved in a grassroots movement, that is that a strategy needs to include many, many different levels. Is that it needs to include organizing grassroots people to respond. It needs to include grassroots education. At the same time, we were doing lots of just going to churches and telling people. It's very important that the people who are most affected be allowed to speak. And that was the whole idea about letting refugees have a platform to say, this is why I left. The death squads came to my office. They were going to kill me. That's why I left. Instead of listening to what the government was saying, these people are economic refugees. That's why they left. Letting the people speak. Secondly, was work through the legal system, but don't ever depend on the legal system to be the only way to do it. The media is a very important part of it. That if any movement that's probably going to have any kind of a success at all needs to work on all those levels. in this country, because it's a big country, it's a complex country. It's, it includes many different ways of thinking.
I was interested of those people who were indicted.
Yeah.
How many were they all American citizens?
There was one priest, a Mexican priest.
Okay. I could see their strategy. I may be wrong. If you indict people who are prominent higher up in the movement, you'll give them more publicity in the press. So they just wanted to win the case to make their point, so they indict the little fish. They really weren't after the big ones.
Well, they did. No, but they went after John Fife and Jim Corbett and Darlene Nagorski, who had been very public. They went after them, and they did indict them. And so,
was there also an issue of them coming into your churches that your Bible studies in?
I was going to get to that. I don't know if we have time. I think it's time for us to quit. I don't know if you want me to give you a 5-minute, 3-minute discursus on that. We didn't do anything about what we felt was the freedom of religion issue at first, because we were just overwhelmed with the trial. We just, I talked to John Fife one day when we were organizing about the trial. I says, what do you think we should do about this? He says, all we can do is complain about it. And that didn't satisfy me, really. And so what I and a couple other people did is we organized a conference on freedom of religion. And we asked a number of people who are well-known.